Gather round, take a seat, relax. It's the Verbringen with Rabbi Levi Avtzon, right here on 101.9 High FM.
High FM. My name is Rabbi Levi Avtzon. It's a privilege and an honor to be here with you on this Tuesday, the Tuesday before Purim. We're still sober. No, just kidding. Always sober. But the Tuesday before Purim, here we are. And let's be honest, it's a hard Purim this year, challenging Purim this year, and a challenge that we're up for. So first of all, I want to wish everybody, because by the time we have the next show, Purim will be behind us. So I want to start off by wishing us all a Freilichim Purim, a happy Purim. And usually that is self-evident, right? Purim and happiness, they belong together. They're the synonyms of one another. But then there are Purims that really challenge us. It's not the first Purim in our history. Purim is a very old holiday. It's at least 2,500 years old, plus minus. It's an old, old holiday. We've been celebrating it before the beginning of the Second Temple. So it's we've been around for a while. The Second Temple was destroyed in the year 70 and lasted for hundreds of years. So this is before that. So just about 2,500 years we've been celebrating it. And let's be honest, many of those years for 2,500 years were not fantastic ones. This is not the first time that we're facing a Purim that's really challenging who we are. I'm actually going to share a story to start off the show with a Purim story that didn't take place that long ago. It took place, 1953. So was it 71 years ago? Okay, 71 years ago. And there's many different angles to the story, but I'll share my family angle. So 1953 was 8 years after the Holocaust, 8 years after World War II. And for many of the survivors who managed to move on, and obviously never really move on, but move forward. They moved to Israel. They moved to the United States, to Australia. Some moved to South Africa, etc. And they were able to somehow start building their lives. But unfortunately, quite a few of the survivors and quite a few of many Jews were locked behind the Iron Curtain. So in World War II, the Allies, basically America, Britain, France, etc., fought on the side of Russia because they all had a common enemy, the fascist, the Nazi party. But immediately as the war ended, that divide between the West and the USSR, the Soviet Union, started going very, very broad. And that's when the famous statement from Churchill, the Iron Curtain has gone up, and the entire Eastern Europe pretty much went under the Iron Curtain. And the person who was leading, who was the leader of the USSR, was a fellow named Joseph Stalin, someone you really hoped never to have to meet. If you want to read a bit about Stalin, there's a lot of biographies. One of the ones that I found the most haunting was Stalin's daughter. It's not actually about Stalin, it's about his daughter who actually made it over to the West and moved over to the United States. A crazy story. But anyway, Stalin was a psychopath by any standard of definition. It's only because Hitler was living, you know, did his thing at the same time as Stalin, that Stalin has been forgotten by many in history. But the middle of the 20th century had a lot of nutcases, and not just nutcases, tyrants, psychopaths. Mao in China, who starved over 50 million people of his own to death. Stalin killed over 25, 30 million people of his own. And then there's Hitler. So it was the middle of the 20th century was a crazy time. And Stalin was an absolute psychopath. I'm not a diagnostician, but based on his behavior. In the early 30s, he caused the famous, I think it was called the Commodore, but like the starvation of Ukraine. And literally 5 million Ukrainians in the early to mid 30s died from starvation. Just because he decided to grab everything they owned And it was a man-made starvation, believe me. I mean, Ukraine is till today the biggest exporter of wheat in the world. So they were doing fine until he decided to make everything the government's. State capture, the most literal sense. Anyways, and then Stalin went, the next phase was persecuting religion. The late 30s, he went on an absolute bloodbath of religious people. Specifically from a Jewish angle, he went and persecuted many, many religious leaders, rabbis, shochtim, moalim, anybody that had anything to do with Jewish leadership, including relatives of mine. Two of my great uncles in 1938. Remember, this is not World War II. This is not the Holocaust. This is Stalin's purges. The year 1938 in Hebrew spelled the year Tafresh Sadek Ches Tirzach, which unfortunately was a year of bloodbath. The Jews that were living in the former Soviet Union had a horrible, horrible year. And then World War II started right after, and that gave them a bit of a respite from Stalin's purges. But unfortunately, Hitler came full in 1941. He went in Operation Barbarossa and went in and caused havoc. This is before the gas chambers are really taking on their role, which started a bit later, 42, 43. In 1941, the Einsatzgruppen would come in town to town. They went very deep, basically most of Ukraine, all of Ukraine and parts of Russia, and they massacred way over a million Jews just by bullets. It was called the Holocaust of Bullets. And including many relatives of mine. That's where most of my relatives that died in the Holocaust did not die in the gas chambers. They died by being shot or buried alive in 1941, 1942. My great-grandparents from my mother's side, great-uncle, great-aunt, and other relatives were all killed then. So just understanding, I'm giving you this history because to appreciate the lead-up to 1953. It's not as if they had an easy time ever since the communist revolution in 1918. Before that, they had the czars, which were far from paradise as well. But the communist revolution, then the persecution of religion, then the mass starvation of Ukraine, then more persecution, then the Holocaust. Eventually, Russia gained its footing and managed to push the Nazis out. But by that stage, the Nazis had killed way over a million. That's why many of the numbers that of the Holocaust, they say 6 million, now they say it's close to 7 million. A big part of the discrepancy is the Jews that were killed in these villages because they weren't as documented. The Jews who arrived in the Poland to the various concentration camps, it was all documented. But over here, it wasn't documented. They would come into a town, collect 5 Jews, 100 Jews, 500 Jews, take them to the nearby forest and kill them. Anyway, World War II ends. After the Nazis kind of left in 1941, 1942, the Jews kind of had escaped, and the persecution of religion had kind of calmed down. Stalin was too busy waging World War II and doing, you know, trying to do his part. So he kind of calmed down. But as the war ended, 1946, 1947, the iron whirls back up, and he starts taunting the West, and they have they start having the crazy race. The nuclear race and eventually the space race, etc. Anyways, 1953, setting the scene. Stalin was a vicious anti-Semite. And remember, many of his Jews had just been persecuted in World War II. All of them were Holocaust survivors or had suffered huge amount of loss. But for the Jews, although the Jews in America, this and that, were maybe the, you know, people had compassion for the Holocaust survivors, in Russia, there was nothing like that. And he decided once and for all to create his own final solution. But his final solution wasn't really going to be killing everybody. At least that wasn't the declared plan. But he was going to exile all the Jews to a place, I believe, in Birbijan, which was far out. He even created a Jewish city, which was and the official language of the area was going to be Yiddish. And he was going to exile everybody. And his way of doing it was by creating what he called the doctor's plot. So you could Google it and you could read the doctor's plot, Stalin, and you'll get the story. And basically, in short, most of his doctors, if not all of his doctors, were Jews. And he came up with an accusation that said the doctors are trying to poison him. And he had all these doctors, I think more than 10 doctors, arrested and used that false claim that the doctors are trying to poison him, etc., to hype up the anti-Semitism, which unfortunately in Europe has never died down. Even 6 million Jews killed a few years before was not enough to satiate the blood of these anti-Semites. And there was this huge anti-Semitism in 1953 in Russia. And the Jews who are living there, again, if they would escape, they could. They could if they would, but they have no way out. And that sets up the Purim, and the Purim of 1953, which, as we're reaching Purim 2024, obviously each case is dissimilar and different, but I'm trying to find inspiration from my own family story, which I'll continue to share. But first, it's song time. Let's lighten up the mood, and let's actually have a very light, easy song. I think we chose the song Happy Days, did we? That's right. Happy Days are coming. This is 101.9 Chai FM, Happy Days.
This is the Verbringen with Rabbi Levi Avtzon on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is 101.9 Chai FM. My name is Rabbi Levi Avtzon, and here we are. If you're just tuning in now, just before the song Happy Days, we were sharing a story of Purim 1953, which is coming to mind. And again, there's many angles to the story, but I'm going to share the personal family angle to the story. But basically, 1953, it's 8 years after the Holocaust. Millions of Jews are locked behind the Iron Curtain. They can't get out. Stalin put up the what's called the Iron Curtain. And then he decides to create this doctor's plot where he basically accused his doctors of trying to poison him, hyped up this anti-Semitism, and then was planning on creating this massive transfer of millions of Jews to the far east of the territories, of basically exile and kill many Jews, etc. It was going to be a horrible time. And many of these Jews had literally just gone through the Holocaust, or most of their family was killed in the Holocaust. And that's where it gets personal, including my grandparents. So all sets of my grandparents, all four grandparents come from Russia, but my paternal grandparents, the Avtzons, managed to get out and escape. There was a small window in 1946, where if you claimed a Polish citizenry, you were able to get out of Russia and get it over to Poland and eventually into the side of the West, and then eventually made it over to the United States. But my other set of grandparents kind of got stuck, and they didn't manage to get out and were locked in the former Soviet Union. They only managed to get out in 1966. So 1953, their redemption from the Iron Curtain was a long way. They still had 13 years. And this was after both my grandparents lost many of the family. My grandfather lost his entire family, every single relative, father, mother, sister, brother, brother-in-law, sister-in-law, and nephews. His entire family was killed in the war. And it's 1953. They're sitting in Moscow now, in the outskirts of Moscow. And they know that Stalin is planning on persecuting them. And as horrible as their life was under communism, it's going to get much worse. And Purim arrives. So, how do you celebrate Purim 1953 when you're literally 8 years after World War II, when you're still being persecuted and you have this massive decree on your head and huge anti-Semitism all across everywhere around you? How do you handle it? So many of, first of all, there were very few Jews at that stage that were even celebrating Purim, because this was 1953 and the communists took over in 1918. So this is 35 years after the communist revolution. And one of the big ideas of communism is that it was a forced atheism on people. You didn't have a choice. Religion was very much persecuted. All religious leaders were killed or exiled, as I mentioned earlier. So how many religious Jews were there in Russia in 1953? I don't know the stats, but hundreds, maybe 1,000, 2,000, very, very few. Millions of Jews, but most of them were 35 years of forced assimilation. Very few. So there's my grandfather living in the outskirts of Moscow with my grandmother. At that stage, he has a few children, I think maybe 7, 8 kids. And Purim. And their hearts are heavy, very heavy. What are you going to do? Dance? Celebrate? Who are you fooling? You just went through World War II and you're about to be exiled again. But they made a decision, just like Jews throughout history. They made a decision that Purim's a time of joy. Not avoiding the pain, despite the pain, to counter the pain, to overcome the pain, to create a miracle. And my grandfather describes in his autobiography, Deep in the Russian Night, he describes how one of my uncles and another relative that was there, because my uncle, my grandparents had a cousin, a nephew and niece, and their family that lived not too far. So how these two kids, 5, 6 year olds, suddenly see all the tension in the room, even though there was joy, it was a very tense joy. And they put their hand on around the shoulder of each other, a nice Russian dance, and they start jumping up and down for Purim with a Purim melody. And he says, as they saw the kids dancing, all of them around the table had a feeling that said, okay, something good is going to happen. If the kids are feeling joy, that means a miracle is happening. The next day, the radio, it goes on the Russian radio that Stalin is sick. Now, in a communist state, you never inform people when the Stalin is sick. They all understood that it meant Stalin's dead. And indeed, it was dead. And it came out that Stalin had died on Purim. And in the hindsight of 70 years, it's hard to appreciate what kind of miracle it is. And also the fact that most of us don't really... I remember I often share stories about my family, and I often feel that people don't really get it because, like, most people didn't really have family that went through communism, especially here in South Africa. Most people came here long before communism. Their grandparents came here. And even those that survived the Holocaust, they came right at, but communism wasn't a part of their existence. It's just an interesting ideology or maybe a crazy ideology, but it's an important story to tell. It's a story of 4 million Jews that lived through communism, and many of them managed to get out when communism fell down in 89 and 90. It's a story of 70 years from 1918 to 1989. It's a Jewish story. It's also not only a Jewish story. It's a story of China. It's a story of Venezuela. It's a story of Cuba. It's a story of many communist states in Africa as well that caused unbelievable suffering. Way over 100 million non-combatants were killed just in the 20th century by communism. But I'm not here about the 100 million, although that's important. I'm here about one family and one miracle and one story, because it's only 70 years ago. It's post-World War II. And you cannot understand the miracle. Stalin was after Lenin died, I think Lenin died in 1924, Stalin took over. It was a big fight between him and Trotsky. And he took over and then led the former Soviet Union by killing everyone, including his own family. I mean, he was an absolute nutcase for 30 years. And he was capable of anything. He was capable of anything. And the moment he died, the relief that it brought to the people, obviously communism still lasted till 1989, 1990, but in Russia. But the relief was imminent. Right away, all the doctors were released. The anti-Semitism went much more undercover. The new leadership at the time removed a lot of Stalin's madness. They were still communists. They were far from, you know, democratic, lovely characters. But compared to Stalin, they were saints. And it literally brought millions of Jews respite. Promise, a miracle. But that was once they heard the story. But Purim, when they showed up to Purim, it looked like hell. They couldn't imagine that things would turn around. All they knew is Purim's arriving and you need to have joy. And that's why I'm sharing the story now, because Purim's arriving no matter what. And we have a choice. And I'll be honest, I'm not going to say that it was an easy choice for me. I struggled. I really, really struggled. Putting together the Purim programs, I was torn for a while. I was like, should we have a Purim event on Saturday night in our shul? Should we just have an event on Sunday? And I was back and forth trying to get people's input. And obviously the feeling was like, nah, should we? And eventually I just had to make this decision. Yes, we're going. But it was hard. Like, it's not natural to want to just have a chill party. And it's not, at least for myself and many around us, it's not natural. No one's saying it's easy. Just like Simchas Torah, let's remember that this attack, the October 7th attack, happened in Israel, it was Simchas Torah, and in diaspora, it was just before Simchas Torah. So it happened Shmini Atzeret, right, Saturday morning. That night was Simchas Torah, and we had to dance. And by that night, we didn't know the full scale, but we knew there was captives. We knew there was a murder. That we knew that was mad. We knew that this was an event like none in many of our lifetimes. And almost every shul in the world made a conscious decision to dance, to defy. And since then, we've had Hanukkah. We had various holidays, but we haven't had anything like Simchas Torah. The only other day that's like similar to Simchas Torah in terms of its joy and maybe even transcends it in many ways is Purim. So Purim is the big challenge. 6 months down the line, can we find joy? And the answer that I believe is 100%. Not only can we must. As this song that just came out, it's in Hebrew from my favorite artist, Yishai Ribo, a favorite artist of many. And it's all about that the rains and the tears and the ground will lead forth to growth. It's his most recent song. It came out last week called Porchim Leshuvam on 101.9 Chai FM. See you after the song.
This is the Fabringen with Rabbi Levi Avtson on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is 101.9 Chai FM. My name is Rabbi Levi Avtson. That was a magnificent song from Yishai Ribo. That the tears that we're pouring on the ground is eventually going to achieve that the ground can sprout forth. That's really the message that we're trying to bring across about this year's Purim. I really believe we have to make a conscious effort for joy, not despite what's going on, but because of what's going on. Because our greatest antidote to evil is life. The opposite of evil, the opposite of darkness, the opposite of death is energy, is life. Now, there's different kinds of joy. There's frivolous joy, which is just like being silly. And then there's a conscious joy. And that's a joy that says, I am here dafka. I'm making a conscious decision that I am fighting against the tyranny. I'm fighting against the evil. I'm fighting against the murder. I'm fighting against all that happened on October 7th and 6th, and I'm fighting it by living, because our enemy worships death. Our enemy worships terror. Our enemy worships destruction. We worship life. That's what we are. Bacharta b'chaim, we choose life. And life is not only just simply living and breathing, it's living. It's living in full. It's living the full with your whole heart, wholehearted living. And if we're going to fight our enemy, then we have to fight with what we have. And the greatest fight is not the fight of bullets. It's not the fight of war. The greatest fight is the mental fight. Because the enemy wins when they play with our heads. The enemy wins when they make us question, right? When you have so many anti-Semites and so many useless idiots around the world that are going against us and telling us, oh, disproportionate, oh, just hand your other cheek. Who do you guys think you are? And you brought this all upon yourselves, and it's all because of the occupation. And you hear all that rubbish, and you start believing it. And then they won. They won when they take over the head. One of the saddest things is when you see fellow Jews who totally buy into these narratives. And you're like, really? Were you not able to, for 6 months, you can't hold your head and just be able to differentiate good and evil? Can you not see that if every evil tyrant in the world is on one side of this war, plus a bunch of moral confused idiots, and on the other side are people of decency and morality, can you not see that this is very black and white? That yes, there is nuance, but the Don't let the nuance get in the way of the clarity, because that's what intellectualism does. An intellectual can break down every little detail, and by the time you're done, you can no longer see the difference between day and night, between good and evil. This is a war between good and evil. And my heart breaks for those well-intentioned people who can't see that, who are just so gullible and just fall into platitudes and simplistic explanations of very complex things and can then lose their clarity. But we should not lose our clarity. And when we remember our clarity and we realize that this is a battle between good and evil, then what is goodness? Life. Torah tells us, right, you should be able to see the difference between good and bad, life and death. Life is good. Death is evil. So living, not just living as in being alive and breathing, but living with your heart is the greatest antidote. So this Purim, this Saturday night, Sunday, we're being given an opportunity to show up with what we do best, simcha, joy, life. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, in the 2,500 years since Purim, the original Purim story, we've had many very hard Purims. Maybe in our lifetime we haven't had many hard Purims, but in our history we have. And being a Jew means that you have a strong history. You know where you come from, even if you're not an historian. You know your basic story, and you know that we've had it rough. And yet Purim has always come as the greatest antidote to say, "If you're going to take down my joy." Not only are you breaking my body, not only are you hurting me physically, but you're going to take away my simchat hachayim, the joy of life. You're going to take away my faith. You're going to take away my history. You're going to take away my belief in miracles. Never. You have no power over me. Nothing. Even if you hold the gun, even if you hold the political power, you might have power over my physical. You might have power over my bank account. You have no power over my mindset. And that's what this weekend is. It's a huge challenge of our mindset. And Purim is always preceded by the Shabbos before Purim is always preceded by Shabbos Zachar, right? Zachar, the most important Torah reading of the year, where it's a biblical obligation to hear it. Remember what Amalek did to you. We always read it the Shabbos before Purim, and this year, literally, Purim is that same night, Saturday night. What are we trying to do? Why are we trying to remember this just before Purim? There's many answers, but one of the basic answers is, remember that since the beginning, since we left Egypt, and even during Egypt, there was always someone trying to hurt us, and still celebrate Purim. Because remember, they tried. They maybe were even somewhat successful in hurting us. But they always go. And we survive. Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker, the prophet promises us, the eternity of the Jewish people doesn't lie. Just look and see the eternity. Look and see that no matter what anti-Semite, no matter what excuse, whether they hated us because of religion, they hated us because of race, they hated us because of Israel, or they just simply hated us because they can't even explain it, or a thorn in their side. Every one of them, no matter how much they hurt us, they disappear to history. They're meaningless. They wasted the life God gave them on hate. Idiots. That's what you have to do. Didn't you learn Genesis? Didn't you learn what God promised Abraham? I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. History has proven that every single time, no matter how much they hurt us, all those who try to hurt us end up disappearing from history. And it's not a gotcha. It's a fact. It's a truism of life. And that's to remind us that no matter how hard it is, and no matter how isolated we might feel, and betrayed we might feel, Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker, the eternity of the Jewish people doesn't end. And Purim is the time to celebrate it. Purim's the time to celebrate our eternity, our promise, and the fact that we have it within us to overcome every single time. We're greater than them. Hashem yilachem lachem. God is fighting for us. God is fighting with us. And as long as we do the right thing and stay on the side of goodness and we don't get morally confused and we don't get bogged down by pettiness and we don't allow ourselves to be taken down by sadness, we'll be okay. And we, please God, will see this year our own Purim miracle. Please God, may our captives come home. Please God, may our enemies be won. May they lose. Please God, may there be peace for all the citizens of Israel, all the good, willing citizens of Israel. That's what we achieve. We don't want war. We want peace. But not peace through being a victim and not peace through weakness, but peace through knowing this is our land. God promised it. It's our land. And all good people are welcome. But we have the moral legitimacy to that land. We are not occupiers. We've never left. It's our home. Am Yisrael Chai. Please God, may we see the miracle in our time. Finishing off with some magnificent Purim music. My name's Rabbi Levi Avtzen of Linksfield Shul. Have a great day. Chag Purim Sameach.